After a deadly drone strike on Ukraine's capital, President Trump says Russia is making a big concession in peace talks with Ukraine by not taking over the whole country. We get the view from Ukraine on Morning Edition from NPR News. A Michigan congresswoman says hundreds of immigration-related arrests have taken place since January at a bridge between Detroit and Canada. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez. Almost all of them, she says, are from drivers making a wrong turn. Also, years of fighting in the Sudanese civil war have hollowed out the capital of Khartoum. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwoto saw the aftermath of what he calls the surreal level of destruction. It's Friday, April 25th. On this day in 1954, scientists at Bell Labs demonstrated the first solar battery powering a radio. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump will fly to Rome today for the funeral for Pope Francis tomorrow. The Pope died this week of a stroke and heart ailments. After the funeral, world leaders and tourists will go home, but the Catholic Church's top clergy will stay on. Some will join a papal conclave to elect Francis's successor. In Rome, NPR's Lauren Freyer spoke to one of the electors.
Cardinal Vincent Nichols is the Church's top official for England and Wales, and this will be his first conclave.
It's intimidating, frankly.
To choose a leader for the world's 1.4 billion Catholics. Nichols is part of the most diverse college of cardinals ever. A majority of those voting were appointed by Francis. And now they'll choose his successor via secret ballot in the Sistine Chapel under ceilings painted by Michelangelo.
The magnificence of that chapel will be focusing everything we try and do.
All cardinals are invited to meetings in the lead-up, but only those under age 80 go into the conclave to vote. Nichols says he feels lucky. His 80th birthday isn't until November. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Rome.
A federal judge in California has issued a ruling on sanctuary jurisdictions. The judge blocked the Trump administration from freezing federal funds to the jurisdictions that limit police cooperation with immigration authorities. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports the judge says President Trump's executive order is unconstitutional.
In the order, signed on his first day in office, President Trump instructed Attorney General Pam Bondi and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to withhold federal funds from sanctuary cities. This injunction was requested by San Francisco and over a dozen other municipalities in California, Oregon, Connecticut, and New Mexico. It temporarily bars the administration from taking any action to withhold or condition federal funds. In 2017, during the prior administration, a similar executive order was also found unconstitutional. The administration must notify all federal departments of this order by next Monday. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell says President Trump's global tariffs are hurting Americans because they're a tax on everyone. Speaking to a group of business leaders yesterday in Kentucky, the former Senate Majority Leader says that trade wars hurt all Americans, but especially people in his home state.
We've had bourbon wars in the past, and it's very easy for a foreign country to have a bourbon war because they don't make it and we do. 95% of it is made in Kentucky.
McConnell says that Kentucky is very dependent on international trade. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom says his state is now the world's fourth largest economy. He says California has overtaken the economy of Japan to secure the spot. Last week, California sued the Trump administration over actions to impose global tariffs. Newsom says these tariffs specifically hurt California. He says they've caused chaos and inflict higher costs on California consumers and businesses. New Jersey authorities have arrested a suspect they allege committed arson and launched a wildfire in the southern part of the state this week. From member station WHYY, Kenneth Burns reports the wildfire has burned more than 15,000 acres and is half contained.
Officials are confident that 19-year-old Joseph Kling started the fire. Ocean County Prosecutor Bradley Billheimer shared limited details during a Thursday news conference.
We were able to place him at the scene And we have some witness statements that corroborate that.
Kling was taken into custody Wednesday and is currently being held at the Ocean County Jail on second-degree aggravated arson and third-degree arson. Bill Hymer hopes the arrest sparks a conversation about the dangers of starting a fire in the woods, particularly when conditions are dry. For NPR News, I'm Kenneth Burns in Waretown, New Jersey.
Texas lawmakers have passed legislation to create an enormous school voucher program. The $1 billion plan will let parents use taxpayer money to pay for tuition at private schools for children. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says he will sign it. Opponents of vouchers say this will drain money from public schools and will hurt children from low-income families. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics with On Swift Horses, starring Daisy Edgar Jones and Jacob Elordi. A married woman explores a secret love upon the arrival of her brother-in-law, who gambles on his own hidden romance. Now playing in theaters.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Did you know that First Avenue, Minneapolis's iconic music venue, started as a bus depot? In 1937, the Greyhound Bus Depot opened at 701 First Avenue North, designed in the sleek Art Modern style. By the 1960s, bus travels began to decline. In 1970, the station was transformed into a nightclub called The Depot, hosting legendary acts like Joe Cocker and Ike and Tina Turner. Over the next few years, the venue had a few rebrandings. It was 1981 when the club was renamed First Avenue and 7th Street Entry, soon becoming a cultural landmark. Prince famously put First Ave on the map when he filmed Purple Rain and featured the venue in select scenes. Since then, First Avenue has been a launchpad for countless artists. From buses to bands, First Avenue's journey is a crucial part of Minnesota's vibrant music history.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Ukraine is marking a day of mourning today.
At least 12 people died in Russian drone and missile strikes on the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. President Trump scolded Russian President Vladimir Putin on social media for the attacks. Trump says he wants peace quickly. He says Ukraine must accept concessions and that Russia is making a pretty big concession by not occupying all of Ukraine.
NPR's Ukraine correspondent Joanna Kakissis joins us now from Kyiv. Joanna, tell us more about this latest Russian attack on the capital.
Well, there is a lot of anger and grief here, as to be expected. We spoke with 40-year-old Maria Rumyantseva, who scrambled to evacuate her elderly mother before a Russian missile destroyed their home. She said Russian attacks on Ukraine seem to have escalated after Trump started accommodating Russia in peace talks. And she had this question for President Trump.
How do I get my mother, a disabled person in a wheelchair, down from the second floor to the first floor to the bomb shelter alone in 8 minutes?
We also spoke to Olena Kurkovska, who ran out of her home in her bathrobe just before the walls caved in. She believes Trump is sacrificing Ukraine for a quick deal.
Trump is simply selling Ukraine and giving it away. And Ukraine cannot give up its territories. Even though these are occupied, this is our territory. Ukrainians live here.
Now, most Ukrainians refuse to recognize Ukrainian land occupied by Russia as part of Russia. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has refused to accept demands by the Trump administration to do so.
Before this attack, Trump blamed Zelensky for prolonging the war, and he was largely seen as accommodating Russian demands. Has this attack changed that at all?
Well, no, I mean, Trump did chide Putin on social media for the attack, but he also said that Russia is already making a big concession by not occupying all of Ukraine. And statements like this obviously make Ukrainians very nervous, especially coming from the leader of the U.S., which was once Ukraine's strongest single ally. Now, Zelensky says his country wants peace. He has agreed to an unconditional 30-day ceasefire brokered by the U.S. last month, something Russia did not agree to. And Zelensky's team is finalizing a minerals deal that could make the U.S. a lot of money. So in return, Ukraine wants the U.S. to provide security guarantees so Russia does not invade their country again. But the Trump administration so far is only offering vague promises.
I remember being in Kyiv with you, Joanna, 3 years ago, and everyone I spoke to just told me how much they love America. I mean, adoration for America. I'm wondering now if Ukrainians still have that optimism about the U.S. coming to their aid at this point.
Well, I'm still hearing some hope. In the northeastern city of Sumy recently, I spoke to Commander Oleg Shiryaev. He is with the 225th Separate Assault Brigade, and here's what he had to say. He's saying, I do not believe in friendship between the United States and Russia. It is impossible. He said such a friendship defies history and the interests of the West. But when I pressed him about the U.S. cutting off military aid to Ukraine last month, he admitted that this could happen again. And then he said Ukraine will try to defend itself on its own as long as it can.
That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thanks.
You're welcome.
For more on this, we're going to go to historian and analyst Sergei Rachenko of Johns Hopkins University. He's an authority on Russia. We reached him at a security conference in Berlin. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Morning.
So taking advantage of the fact that you're in Europe, what are you hearing from European security experts about what seems to be the U.S. posture toward these negotiations? Seems very weighted, or at least sympathetic toward Russia's demands, and less interested in Ukraine's desire for a security guarantee. How's that going over there?
Well, sure. The Europeans are frustrated with American posture. They have been calling for a stronger approach to Russia. But when we say the Europeans, we have to be clear that Europe is not speaking with a united voice. We have the French, we have the Germans, we have the British, who are also pushing for a more, you know, collective European approach. But then we have dissenting voices. We have the Hungarians, who are very much on the same page as the Trump administration. So there's, as always with Europe, you know, there's a variety of views. But generally, I would say the European attitude is that the Americans are making too many concessions to the Russians without getting anything in return.
Is there anything in particular that is sort of standing out to you there? I mean, I'm thinking, as part of the deal, Russia wants to keep all the territory it seized from Ukraine since 2014. How is that being received?
Well, that is not being received very positively, obviously, in Europe, because there's a fear of a precedent. And they're especially worried about this idea that the Trump administration has aired about the U.S. recognizing Russian annexation of Crimea. They fear that this will set a precedent for the future, that aggression can be rewarded in this sort of way. And that is the essence of the current dialogue between the Europeans on the one hand and the Americans on the other. Of course, the Ukrainians also do not want to yield to this kind of demands on the part of the Russians.
And what about, you were just, you know, pointing out that Europe doesn't speak with one voice on this. What about countries like Hungary, for example, that tend to be, you know, more skeptical toward Ukraine and are more sympathetic to the Russian position? Are they equally worried about that?
Well, the Hungarian, I mean, you've got a few voices in Europe who are basically having their own approach to Russia. They sometimes can be brought along in collective action within the context of the European Union. And I would say the more important voices are those of France and Germany, as always. The British have been trying to play a role as well. They have been proposing, together with the French, to send contingents to Ukraine, but only after peace has been established. So this position, by the way, strikes me as somewhat unrealistic, because peace is certainly not at hand. And also the Russians have made it clear that they will not accept European contingents, certainly not ones by NATO member states. So I'm not really sure that the Europeans at this point as a whole have a clear and defined position on how to handle this. And that makes it even more problematic for them when the Trump administration goes in and offers a range of concessions to the Russians and basically tells the Europeans, well, you know, come along with us, or if you don't, then we'll leave this problem to you. You'll have to sort it out.
You know, one interesting thing, as part of the U.S. proposal for peace, now Secretary of State Marco Rubio seems to be advocating for something that he opposed when he was in the U.S. Senate, which is recognizing Washington, recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea. And I wondered if that pivot has been noted?
Well, of course it has been. The Europeans are talking about nothing else at the moment. The question is, do you reward aggression by recognizing Russian annexation of Crimea? You might say, well, this is just recognizing reality because there's no viable way for Ukraine to regain Crimea. But the detractors say that in 1940, for example, the United States refused to recognize the Soviet annexation of the Baltic states, and that allowed the Baltic states to regain their independence or help them regain their independence at the end of the Cold War. So what does the United States have to gain here by basically giving Crimea to Putin on a silver platter? That is not so clear. But from the Trump administration perspective, they see that as a major carrot, as a major incentive for the Russians to cooperate. I would say at the moment, the Europeans and the Americans do not see eye to eye on this question of Crimean recognition.
What about President Trump's comments that he was, quote unquote, not happy about Russia's latest attacks on Ukraine and saying, Vladimir, stop? I was wondering what the reaction was to that.
Well, I think this makes Trump appear weak, certainly not, you know, obviously to the Europeans, but also to the Russians. You don't end this war by calling on Putin to stop. You force Putin to negotiate. You come from, you know, to the table from a position of strength. And I don't think that making this kind of desperate proclamations via social media actually helps anything. It creates doubts about Trump's ability to actually get anything out of Putin.
That's historian and analyst Sergei Radchenko of Johns Hopkins University. We reached him in Berlin. Mr. Radchenko, thank you so much for speaking to us once again.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
The man who opened fire on a July 4th parade near Chicago 3 years ago will spend the rest of his life in prison. It was one of the worst mass shootings in Illinois history. A judge ordered Robert Cremo III to serve 7 life sentences for murdering 7 people. He wounded dozens more. Here's WBEZ's Anna Savchenko.
Robert Cremo III was supposed to go to trial for the mass shooting in March, but on the first day, he surprised the court by pleading guilty. Because of that, many survivors and the loved ones of those who lost their lives were never able to share their stories in court. But this week's emotional 2-day sentencing hearing finally gave them that chance. Liz Turnipseed was one of those survivors. She was shot in the pelvis at the parade and now needs a cane to walk. But she said the sentence Cremo got was vindicating.
We're going to mourn those that we lost, and they're always going to be in our hearts and our minds. But at the end of the day, he's the loser. He's going to prison for the rest of his life, and we're never going to have to see him again.
But John Strauss, who lost his father, told the courtroom there was no sense of closure for him. He called his loss an open wound that he would have to nurse forever. The hearing was also a chance for prosecutors to present the evidence they had collected, and they called Brian Bodden to the stand. The police detective had interviewed Cremo after his arrest. Bodden shared some harrowing details, like how Cremo said he had only intended to shoot adults. At one point, he even told police that he cared about people. And when Bodden asked Cremo, "How can you love people but shoot them up?" Cremo answered, quote, "Sometimes you have to crack a couple of eggs to make an omelet." Outside the courtroom, Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering said it was important for her and the survivors to hear all these details.
We all had our piece of the puzzle, so it was super helpful to get the broader story.
Cremo did not attend the hearing, and Rotering said his absence from the courtroom helped.
The fact that the offender wasn't there gave people almost the space to be more relaxed and more comfortable sharing their individual stories.
As Judge Victoria Rossetti sentenced Cremo to consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, she called him a coward who terrorized the community and is beyond any rehabilitation. For NPR News, I'm Anna Savchenko in Chicago.
This is NPR News.
Pam Perry from Brainerd is a regular contributor to the KAXE Morning Show. She talks about birds and other wildlife. We asked her why she supports this station.
So, and now the most recent thing is the newsroom. And I love the news reports. You're not hearing that anywhere else. You're not hearing about what county boards are doing and local governments. This is the place. This is where you're going to hear about it. And the music was wonderful. You know, and you had your volunteer hosts. And again, local people often. I want to support it. I want to support something. And then, of course, when I was listening, I was going, where else do you hear about bud break and plants and birds and forestry and all the things that, you know, were Northern Minnesota?
You can become a member like Pam Perry. Give now at KAXE.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The roadways around the Ambassador Bridge connecting Detroit to Canada are notoriously confusing. Just ask any Detroiter. There's lots of traffic, lots of construction, all making for a difficult drive. And as NPR's Jasmine Guards reports, making a wrong turn onto the U.S. side of the bridge has landed hundreds of immigrants in detention in the past few months.
The tips about the Ambassador Bridge started coming in months ago. That's Sarai describing a drive to Costco on a Saturday morning back in March. NPR's dropping her last name because she's an immigrant without legal status. The mother was with her two kids, aged 1 and 5, both U.S. citizens. So she's driving, and the GPS, she says, routed her onto the bridge. They were detained by CBP. She says she was taken into a windowless office space near the bridge. It was cold. She was held there for nearly 6 days. When her 1-year-old got sick and feverish, she was told there was no medicine. Why aren't you letting me talk to a lawyer? She says she asked officers. It felt like a kidnapping.
A wrong turn should not lead to a disappearance and an erosion of someone's due process.
That's Michigan Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib. Sarai's interview aired on NPR last month. Her story led to an inquiry by Tlaib. On a visit to the site, the congresswoman says Customs and Border Protection officials specifically told her 213 people have been detained there just this year.
Those are the numbers we were given during our site visit. And he offered, he said, well, I just want you to know also, Congresswoman, that 90% of them were actually here in the United States. They just made a wrong turn.
At a press conference on Thursday in Detroit, the representative said she saw a small space without adequate food or accommodations for children.
I saw firsthand those conditions, and we're talking about a room with two basic cots. So this is an office space that is not equipped for detention or long-term stays, especially of families.
NPR knows of 3 U.S. citizen children who were held there. When reached for comment, a spokesperson for CBP disputed that there were 213 people detained since January. He said in a statement, the number is closer to 50. When asked, the spokesman refused to give his name. As the Trump administration ramps up its efforts to keep its promise of a historic mass deportation campaign, there's been reports of increasingly overcrowded detention centers. At Thursday's press conference, Miriam Ackerman, a senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Michigan, says this should not be dismissed as an issue that only affects immigrants without legal status.
Democracies don't deny people access to attorneys. It is naive to think
that if we tolerate such incommunicado detention and disappearances for non-citizens, the government won't start doing the same thing to citizens.
She says what's been happening on the bridge should concern everyone. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
It is Friday, which means it's time for StoryCorps. 15-year-old Acacia Bigley brought her father, Dan, to StoryCorps in Anchorage, Alaska, to talk about how he became blind. It happened before Acacia was born. Dan was on a fishing trip when he accidentally came between a grizzly bear and her cubs. And let me warn you here, his story includes a graphic description of the bear attack.
She dragged me off into the woods and stood over the top of me with front claws digging into either shoulder and her head directly over mine. That's when she cocked her head sideways and bit down across my face. I was in a medically induced coma for those first 12 days. The medical report put it this way. Patient arrived at the hospital in a condition incompatible with life. I'll never forget that first time when your mom came into the hospital room. I couldn't talk, you know, and so I wrote down on a whiteboard, "I'm blind." And she's like, "Yeah, I know." And I wrote down, "I'm scared." I didn't think I was going to be able to have love or have kids.
But why did that make you think you couldn't be a father?
Well, you know me, I always like to joke that I was the first blind person I ever met. And so I had this fear, like, how does a blind guy change diapers? How do I make sure I don't knock my toddler down the stairs? You know, your mom and I had a really tough time. I kind of pushed her away, and she was pretty sad and mad. But I realized that I was stuck in a place of bitterness, and a life of bitterness had more ability to destroy what life I had left than the bear did.
Mm-hmm.
I called your mom and said sorry.
And that's how I'm here today.
Thank goodness.
I know. When I was little, I just knew that there was a lot more things that I had to help you with than other kids. And I thought other parents were different and you were the only normal one.
I remember when you and your brother were really little and you guys would have on your little monkey backpacks with the tails. I would use you guys as my guides, holding onto your monkey tails.
We were your guide dogs.
My guide monkeys. One night we were just sitting there in your bed and you were getting ready to go to sleep and you just said to me, "Dad, are you happy?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm super happy." A moment or two later you said, "So you're blind and you're happy?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm blind and I'm happy."
Dan and Acacia Bigley for StoryCorps in Anchorage, Alaska. Their conversation is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial. Pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company.
This is NPR News.
Improved climate modeling helped forecast the intensity of hurricanes Milton and Helene last year. Now scientists worry that big cuts to weather research may affect the ability to forecast future severe weather events.
If the siren doesn't go off, then you're going to be caught unawares.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The impact of the administration's cuts to climate research on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. I'm Heidi Holton. It's 529. Coming up next, we've got our daily dose of phenology. Looks like it's going to be a really nice day today across northern Minnesota with highs near 60, mostly sunny skies, northeast winds 5 to 10 and gusting higher. Clear overnight tonight with lows in the mid-30s. Don't forget, today is the really big day. It is the announcement 2 hours from now at 7:30. Kari Hedlund, our music director, will be in to give us the lineup for the September 6th Grand Rapids River Fest. Check it out. People have been guessing who might be coming at our Facebook page. You can text us your guesses, 218-326-1234. The question of the week is, tell us about your favorite birds. Text us at 218-326-1234. We receive support from Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. And thanks also goes out to Lakes Tax Advisors, where Ron Berg and his staff offer tax, accounting, and payroll services for Minnesota businesses. With locations in Grand Rapids and Rush City, more information at lakes.tax. Some things going on around our region for this weekend. It is Minnesota's Forest to Tap program tonight, 5 to 7 at area breweries in Baxter, Aiken, Nisswa, Grand Rapids, Walker, Crosby, Bemidji, so many places. Look for Forest to Tap online and find out the closest brewery to you. It's a connection from good, healthy forest to clean water. Here's John Latimer with our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, April 25th in the year 1999, I spot my first yellow-rumped warbler. The yellow-rumped warbler is an interesting bird. It can switch its diet from insects to fruit and back and forth, which allows it to come early in the spring and stay late in the fall. It is one of the last warblers to leave Minnesota in the fall. The average date for the return of the yellow rumps to northern Minnesota is the 24th of April. The earliest was the 29th of March in 2012, and the latest was the 6th of May in 2005. These birds are often seen in the springtime hanging out on the flowers of the red maples. Watch a red maple, beautiful red flowers all over it, and watch as a bird will flit out from the tree and hawk an insect out of the air and then disappear back into the myriad of flowers, fly around, bounce around, scare up another insect, dash out, grab that insect out of the air, dash back to the maple, and follow up its chase for the next mouthful.
Face down. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. and from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Sudan's capital city of Khartoum has been systematically destroyed. The once vibrant city at the junction of the White and Blue Nile has been hollowed out after 2 years of civil war.
The conflict between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, started in Khartoum. Then, over a month ago, in a major shift, the city was liberated by the Sudanese army. Now, for the first time, the outside world is getting a glimpse of what has been left behind. NPR is one of the few Western news outlets that it's made it into Khartoum.
With us now is NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu, who has just returned from there and joins us now from the de facto capital of Port Sudan. So tell us, Emmanuel, what you saw as you traveled through Khartoum.
Good morning. It's utterly devastating and surreal. Before Khartoum became the center of the war, this was a really vibrant, proud, historic city, over 6 million people. But then 2 years of war between these two former allies and then occupation by the Rapid Support Forces until just the last month really has left the city emptied, almost eerie. Swathes of it are torched, damaged, destroyed by artillery and gunfire. And this is from everyday areas to the presidential palace, to hospitals, schools, museums. Even the airport has been burnt to a crisp. Before the RSF were forced out of Khartoum, they stripped the city almost like locusts, you know, looting it to a degree that's honestly just really hard to grasp. And that's from the National Museum, where they took tens of thousands of ancient artifacts, and even down to electric wires ripped from the walls in almost every building that they occupied. And they stripped them for copper. The city is without power, there's a shortage of water, virtually no state services, although they're gradually returning.
So if the city is missing power, shortage of water, I mean, basic services, I mean, can people return?
Well, there are tractors at the moment clearing debris, teams of sweepers cleaning the streets, and they're still finding unexploded bombs and human remains. But you're right, it's mostly uninhabitable. There's a trickle of people returning, but mainly to find out or confront what's happened to their property and their belongings. We went to a bakery and spoke to the owner, Yusuf Aldi. He said the RSF looted his home above the shop, and they lived there, and for a period they even kept the bakery open and ran it like it was their own business.
Emmanuel, also wondering about what you may have witnessed around the humanitarian crisis. I mean, the United Nations says Sudan is experiencing the worst famine anywhere in the world in decades.
Yes, it's unprecedented. We visited the Al-Buluk Hospital, which is the main and largest pediatric health facility in the Khartoum State region. The wards were packed with malnourished children. The hospital's expanded again and again through the war, but it's still overwhelmed. I spoke to the lead doctor, Ahmed Khaloji.
At the beginning of January 2024, we served like 4,000 patients per month. Now it's 30 to 36,000 per month.
So the fighting has stopped in Khartoum, but the toll of the war is really just coming to the surface. And of course, the fighting continues.
Tell us about where the fighting has shifted.
Well, it's shifted to the outskirts of the capital region and has become really intense towards the western region of Darfur, which is overwhelmingly controlled by the RSF. It's where there was a genocide 20 years ago by Arab militias that evolved into the RSF against African ethnic groups. And it's happening again now, according to the UN, US and others.
That's NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu in Sudan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today is the last day people are able to see Pope Francis lying in state at the Vatican. Tens of thousands have filed past his open coffin under the dome of St. Peter's Basilica to pay their respects to the man who led the Roman Catholic Church for the last dozen years. Joining us from Rome is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, so how much more time do people have to see the Pope?
Well, there are just a few hours left of the public viewing, and it's been a time for people from around the world lining up for literally blocks and blocks to see Francis for one final time. Among them was Kelly Gaffigan and her family from Virginia Beach, Virginia. They just happened to be spending spring break here in Rome, and here's how she said she'll remember Francis.
He really, had the best interest of the people as a whole, Catholic and everyone, and the planet. And even though that rubbed people the wrong way, I think he was always doing what was best for us and our world.
And when the viewing ends tonight, the coffin will be sealed in preparation for the funeral mass Saturday morning.
So tell us about the funeral mass.
Well, it's a traditional Catholic requiem mass for the dead, and I've been looking through the program, and a couple of things strike me. First, while it's predominantly in Latin, of course, there are a number of prayers in a variety of languages, Portuguese, Polish, Chinese, Arabic. I think that really speaks to the global nature of the church. And among the readings, the story from the Gospel of John, in which Jesus asks Simon Peter, "Do you love me?" three times. And each time, Simon Peter says, "Yes." And each time, Jesus replies, "Feed my sheep. Feed my flock." I think that really speaks to Francis' understanding of church leaders as shepherds and pastors, and that Christians demonstrate their love for Jesus through service to others, especially those most in need.
You know, Francis isn't being buried in the Vatican itself. First time in over a century that's happening. Where is the burial taking place?
At a church across town called St. Mary Major. It was a favorite of Francis. He prayed there around his trips abroad. But something else strikes me about this burial. One of the people participating in the rite at St. Mary Major is former Archbishop of Los Angeles, Cardinal Roger Mahoney. Now, court records show he was heavily involved in shielding abusive priests from law enforcement. The archdiocese eventually had to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars in abuse claims to survivors. And in fact, his successor barred him from public ministry in Los Angeles. So abuse survivors and victims' advocates are strongly criticizing the church over Mahoney's participation.
Jason, what can we expect after the funeral and the burial?
Well, the funeral begins a period of 9 days of official mourning with daily masses at St. Peter's, which lead up to the conclave itself. And once the conclave gets underway, the voting cardinals are sequestered in the Sistine Chapel and a nearby residence until they select a new pope. They'll take several votes each day until someone gets a two-thirds majority. I asked Kelly Gaffigan, whom we heard from earlier, what she's hoping for in Francis' successor, and here's what she said.
Keep the traditions of our church, but also bring us, you know, into the future, and, you know, hopefully have women included more in the church as well. I think there's definitely a place for us in leadership.
Lots of hopes and expectations for the next head of the Roman Catholic Church.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose in Rome. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. More coming up from National Public Radio. During this spring wildfire season, the Minnesota Interagency Fire Center reminds everyone that the unauthorized use of drones in the vicinity of a wildfire is prohibited. Fire in the Village is a collective of artists and cultural organizers. They host free Friday art jams from 4 to 8 every Friday in their space at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Feel free to bring something you're working on or use the art materials provided to try something new. Iron Range Barn Dances are hosting a Hibbing Hoedown tomorrow at 7 p.m. It's at Maple Hill Community Center. No experience or partners are necessary. Can dance to live music from the O'Neill Family Band. And tomorrow, the Clearwater County Historical Society and Clearwater Lutheran Church are teaming up for a night of food, Scandinavian music, and storytelling. It starts at 5:30 with a free will donation accepted. And Crowing Energized and Central Lakes College host a 5K for mental awareness tomorrow. It begins and ends at the CLC campus in Brainerd. It's at 9 a.m. There's also a 1-mile walk option and a resource fair showcasing local mental health support. The proceeds benefit the Sharing Bread Soup Kitchen and the Central Lakes College Food Pantry. More news is coming up next from Morning Edition. I'm Heidi Holton.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition, the most popular radio news program in the United States, where you get voices of people in the news and reports from around the world. We know you have millions of options to get somebody's opinion on the news, millions of options for a take on the news, but few options where you can get people who dig up facts. and go to the scene to look and give you the information to make your decision. And this public radio station is the place for that, where you get NPR News.
This public radio station is KAXE. We are people-powered. We are not governed by algorithms or corporations. We are governed by people, people like you. We need you to join us and keep us people-powered. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton, and I thank you for your support.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Tomorrow, the Rails to Trails Conservancy wants people to hop on their bikes or lace up some sturdy walking shoes to take part in Celebrate Trails Day. It's a group that advocates for trails, and it says thousands of transportation projects are at risk as the Trump administration reviews grants made under President Biden. Chuck Quirenbach of member station WUWM has this report.
Every spring, somewhere between 50 and 100 people take part in what's called a Promise Zone ride to look at planned improvements in economically disadvantaged neighborhoods on Milwaukee's north side. It's a friendly, lively event, as long as you can avoid reckless automobile drivers and the potholes.
You're going right to the potholes. Look at you. You're going to be one of them people.
The Milwaukee area has developed a half dozen major biking and hiking trails on abandoned and active railroad corridors, riverbanks, and power line rights of way. But the Promise Zone ride is on city streets, partly because in this densely populated part of town, the nearest recreational trail is more than 2 miles away.
Unfortunately, we've had people on bikes killed on the streets, you know, lots of car accidents and things like that.
That's Cheryl Blue, a bike rider and economic revitalization official who's part of a coalition that's been trying for years to get a 7-mile trail built alongside a railroad track.
So this project will give people access to an 18-mile loop around the city where they'll be able to bike safely, walk safely through their neighborhoods, and for the children to have a safe place to bike and play.
In early January, the Biden administration awarded the Milwaukee Trail Project $1.6 million for additional planning. But now U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says the department is reviewing that grant, one of 3,200, he says, were announced over the last 3 years. At least a quarter of those grants are related to biking, according to the Rails to Trails Conservancy. At an April Senate committee hearing, Duffy said he likes bikes.
Bikes are healthy. Bikes, oftentimes, many places move people faster.
But Duffy says he's reviewing grants the Biden administration did not finalize. He says they didn't have signed agreements laying out the project's scope, schedule, and budget.
It's easy, you know, to blow the kazoo and send up the balloons when you announce a project. The hard work is actually doing the grant agreement.
However, in March, a leaked policy memo from the DOT indicated another reason for the funding pause. It called for removing elements of projects related to climate change, bike infrastructure, or those that take equity into account. Duffy told the senators he is looking at those factors. The DOT did not respond to requests for additional information. However, Kevin Mills of the Rails to Trails Conservancy says if the federal government's money for trails is not available, most communities can't cover the cost.
It's expensive and beyond the capacity of most local governments to consider picking up the entire tab.
The Rails to Trails Conservancy says it's already working with partners across the country to develop contingency plans. But if awarded grants are terminated, it says that could set trail planning by states and municipalities back significantly. And keeping bike riders on busy streets, the group maintains, could cost lives. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quirenbach in Milwaukee.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm a producer here at KAXE KBXE, inviting you to get downtown with KBXE at the Loft in downtown Bemidji. Going on Thursday, May 1st, with doors opening at 5 p.m., music starting at 6 with Dilly Dally Alley.
Dragging myself from the womb in my room.
Joined by the headliner, Chastity Brown. This event is free and open to everyone, but space is limited. This event is made possible with support from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund of Minnesota.
Amid trade tensions, what happens when Minnesota nice meets Ontario nice?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, farmers are struggling to pay their debts. This is clear from an analysis by Bloomberg Law of bankruptcy filings, and this is before the new higher tariffs started to kick in. Marketplace's Savannah Peters reports.
Bloomberg found farm bankruptcies were up 55% in 2024, and they're trending even higher this year. That tracks with what bankruptcy attorney Don Swanson is seeing.
In fact, I've got a Chapter 12 going right now.
That's the section of the bankruptcy code for farmers. And Swanson says his firm, Coley Jessen in Omaha, has a few more of those cases in the works.
Every debtor has their own issues that are unique to them, but 2024 was a terrible year for farming.
Farmers have been dealing with high input costs and low crop prices. And if all the proposed tariffs go through,
that negative pressure is just going to intensify.
Rabel Chandio is a professor of agricultural economics at Iowa State University. She says whether farm bankruptcy rates rise even faster depends on how long steep tariffs on China last, and whether the Trump administration offers relief payments to cover affected farmers' losses, like it did during the last trade war. I'm Savannah Peters for Marketplace.
Markets, it has been three up days in a row for the S&P 500 stock index. S&P futures are down 0.25% now. NASDAQ futures also just turned down 0.2%. The S&P is down 2.2% in April so far. The Dow is down 4.5% month so far. A published report says Apple is moving to produce all the iPhones sold in the U.S. in India, a pivot away from China. Remember, it says designed by Apple in California. It doesn't say made. The Financial Times has the India scoop today. Now to video gaming. It was delayed for several weeks because of the Trump administration's tariff announcements, but overnight, retailers started taking pre-orders for the Nintendo Switch 2 console. Walmart, Best Buy, and others that are part of this rollout report major demand. The boxes are set to start selling in earnest on June the 5th. You say Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. I say Animal Crossing, New Horizons.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses with customizable coverage options as unique as your business. More at progressivecommercial.com. And by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, and financial software to help businesses manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
Now to the nexus of the U.S. and Canada at a time of fraught trade relations. Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell forded the chasm between Minnesota, USA and Ontario, Canada to the Canadian border town of Thunder Bay. Hi, Chris.
David.
So you get just across the border to Canada. Did you get the stink eye, Mr. U.S. citizen?
People were incredibly nice, David. I just have to emphasize that. You know, Thunder Bay, it's this port city. It's a railway hub. People from Thunder Bay, they cross over into Minnesota, northern Minnesota. And people in northern Minnesota, they go do their shopping in Thunder Bay.
We have a lot of sort of back and forth, you know, whether it's business or whether it's individuals, you know, just going to Grand Marais for the weekend, those kinds of things, going to Duluth, that back and forth activity, hockey teams, soccer teams, etc.
Charlotte Robinson is president of the Thunder Bay Chamber of Commerce, and as you could hear, we met in a diner.
Certainly from a business perspective, it's also been a close relationship. We do a fair bit of trade between some of our larger industries with Minnesota specifically.
She said it's been a close relationship, but now with President Trump's tariffs, 25% on a lot of things, 10% on some energy products, and Canada responding. What's it now? I don't know. Testy, this relationship?
You know, the word that we heard a lot, David, is betrayal. You know, they're unhappy with Trump's insistence that Canada should become the 51st state. And the way they're expressing their displeasure is with their wallets. Cross-border travel is down. Vacation plans to the U.S. are canceled. American liquor, wine, and beer, it's been pulled off the shelves in Thunder Bay and Ottawa. And Livio De Matteo, he's an economics professor at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, notes that even grocery store aisles have changed.
We found oranges from Morocco and Egypt. We'd never really seen that before. So even the retailers are already making the effort. You know, the broccoli's been coming from Mexico, we've noticed, the blueberries from Peru.
All right, so some agility there. But can the Canadian economy decouple itself from the U.S.?
30% of Canada's economy is export-oriented, and three-quarters of its exports go to the U.S. But in the interviews we had, David, Canadian business owners seem determined to reduce their reliance on the U.S. They're creating stronger business ties within Canada, and they're forging direct economic relations with other countries. So James Foltz, he's the founder of Border Giant, is based in Thunder Bay, and the company's software smooths cross-border transactions for small businesses and individuals.
Pretty much every business right across Canada, they're going to start looking at other options in the supply chain rather than USA, even for, you know, distributors and everything. So between the pricing going up and the uncertainty and even the emotional response to, like, you know, the rhetoric with the 51st state and everything like that is, okay, there's really not a path forward. So we need to cut out, like, the ties as best we can and move on to a more certain path.
Chris, once trust goes away, not easy to get back.
No, it isn't. And it's you know, it's, trust isn't easy to measure like land or capital. It's more like a recipe that allows for all kinds of economic activity and innovation. Again, James Foltz.
Once that trust is broken and you have to go somewhere else, you've done the work to look for something else. You've formed another relationship and you don't tend to go back to that.
No one knows how deep the rupture between the two economies is, but Canadian entrepreneurs and businesses, they aren't waiting to find out. They're acting now.
Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell back in Minnesota after a reporting trip to Thunder Bay, Ontario. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And I'll have the global investment management firm with provolone, banana peppers, private equity, and a hedge fund. Did you know Blackstone Group now owns Jersey Mike's Subs? Taste the portfolio in every bite. There's news the founder of Jersey Mike's, Peter Cancrow, is leaving the CEO position now that it's Blackstone. A guy also not named Mike from Wingstop Chicken Wings now takes over. Our executive producer is Kelly Silvera, digital producer Dylan Mietinen, engineers Brian Allison and John Brewington. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, it'll be news headlines from Morning Edition. An hour from now, we bring you the Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton with John Bauer. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, you can contact us 218-326-1234 during business hours. And the board's full meeting schedule is available online at kaxc.org. We are looking for new board members. If you have questions, you can contact us. Text 218-326-1234. Later this morning, we're going to hear part of my conversation with Delina White. Delina is putting on a fashion show tonight in downtown St. Paul. KEXE is proud to be one of the co-sponsors of this event, bringing Ojibwe fashion to Fashion Week. That's going on tonight. It's at Intercontinental Hotel, right downtown in St. Paul. It's made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage.